Hello and welcome back to the Relationship Super Conference. My name is Jaya Bristow and I'm one of your hosts. And today I'm really excited to be welcoming Megjon Barker to the conference. Welcome, Megjon.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. So Megjon Barker is the author of a number of popular books on sex, gender, and relationships, including graphic guides to queer, gender, and sexuality. They've also written How to Understand Your Gender, Life Isn't Binary, Enjoy Sex, How, When, and If You Want To, and Rewriting the Rules, an anti-self-help guide to love, sex, and relationships, as well as Hell Yeah, Self-Care. They have also written a number of books for scholars and counselors on these topics, drawing on their own years of academic work and therapeutic practice. Now, when I found out this was going to be the theme of our next conference, Megjon was the first person who came to mind. So I'm particularly excited to have you on board. A bunch of friends and I have done a book group on your book and I've learned so much. So thank you for being here.
Thank you for an introduction.
And let's start with, do you want to just tell us a little bit about you and what brought you, like what brought you to writing these books and just a little bit about your story?
Yeah, well, I always think back to when I was, I guess, late teens, early 20s, and I would go into the bookshops and look at the self-help section, you know, trying to find some way of understanding why I was struggling so much, why my friends were struggling so much, my family. And so I just, that kind of stayed with me, that sense of like, I want something on this self-help section that's genuinely helpful. And I wasn't finding it back in the 1980s. And I'm not sure there's a lot of it there now even, you know, because the kind of ideas that I've come across that feel really genuinely helpful around sex and relationships and mental health particularly, they just don't seem to filter through into the kind of popular kind of messages that come out. I mean, hopefully this conference will do a bit to help on that. And so I kind of went on a quest, really. I did a psychology degree and a PhD. Then I kind of moved more towards sociology, philosophy. Like, I wasn't really finding the answers in psychology either. I trained as a therapist as well. I went to kind of Buddhism and all kinds of activism as well. Like, looking at who's doing this differently? Who's doing particularly sex and relationships differently, and what are they learning about it? And really now I'm a writer full time now, and my passion is just getting this stuff out there, like trying to bring together all of these kind of ideas and practices that I've found the most useful, that I've kind of found in all these different places, and kind of bring them all together. Like, what's the message? You know, what can people hopefully find genuinely helpful when it comes to navigating their relationships with themselves and others and the world?
That's fantastic. And I'm so glad that you're doing this kind of work. I think it's so important. And
thank you.
Do you feel that there is more people doing this work now? Do you feel that there is more stuff out there around these topics?
Yeah, I think so. I think, but it still feels like some of the most helpful ways of understanding things aren't necessarily getting out there to everybody, or if they do, it's in a kind of form that sometimes misses something. I mean, maybe it comes to the next question that you're going to ask, but I guess a big passion of mine is recognizing that the wider culture and the systems and structures around us are a huge part of the problem. And what you see generally, again, on the self-help section or in kind of programs about that or podcasts about that or whatever, is it's still quite individual. It's like, what's wrong with me and how can I fix it, rather than really situating it in this wider culture that has all these ideas around how we should treat ourselves and other people, which are actually a big part of the problem.
Amazing. And it sounds like what you're pointing to is looking more at the systems rather than the personal and the individual, which I'm all about. I lead workshops on exactly that. So
yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's so important. And even, you know, things like mindfulness, which is, you know, really helpful practices, often by the time it's kind of filtered through to the general public, it's kind of lost some of that, you know, which is that in sort of Buddhist understandings and originally is very much kind of about power structures and the impact they have on people and the wider culture. But it kind of gets a bit lost along the way. And then it's just like, oh, here's this practice you should do, and if you can't do it, you're a bad person or something. It gets a bit twisted, you know, in our culture, because we're so keen to kind of see something wrong with us and go on this kind of journey of self-improvement rather than this kind of collective piece that's so important.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So if we're talking about that and the systems and relationships in general, I know that one of your books and the blog is Rewriting the Rules. Why is it you feel we need to rewrite the rules of relationships?
Yeah, so that was my first sort of attempt at a self-help book, and I even called it an anti-self-help book because, you know, it's kind of not locating the problem in the self. It's more like, hang on a minute, like if we're trying to navigate the world with the rules that we're getting in, you know, Western culture about how to do relationships, we are going to really struggle because that's just not possible. It's completely impossible. This kind of idea that you need to find, this one person who's going to be like the one, you know, who's going to be your best friend and your perfect sex partner forever and cohabit and bring up kids and joint finances and, you know, and it's going to be this really long-term relationship. It's just it's just really quite an impossible goal, and the sense of happily ever after that's kind of put on that, you know, this is going to finally make you happy. So in that book, my suggestion was, you know, that we look at the rules, we try and say, instead of just taking them for granted, we try and say, what are they? So when it comes to love or sex or monogamy, like what's the kind of accepted like way of doing things that we're kind of immersed in? And then why might we question it? What might be problematic about it? What might cause suffering? And if we do want to change it, what else is out there? You know, how are some people doing it differently? Maybe in other cultures around the world at different times, and also within Western culture, kind of on the margins, you know, who's doing it differently and how. And then each chapter ends with a kind of embracing uncertainty, like what would happen if we went beyond this idea of, instead of just replacing one set of rules with another set of rules, like monogamy rules with polyamory rules, like what happens if we completely embrace uncertainty in this area and really question the idea of even having a set of rules that we follow.
And I think that's what I really appreciated about it. You weren't saying mainstream structures and rules are wrong and here is a different set of structures and rules you should adopt. You were saying, let's question things. Let's find out what works for each of us as individuals. Let's find out what we're expected to do, whether that does work for us or whether we need to explore other options. And it's going beyond binaries, which leads us perfectly into the next section. So I know you identify as non-binary. So do you want to just first talk a little bit about going beyond binaries in terms of gender and sexuality? And then we'll talk about going beyond binaries in terms of relationships as well.
Right. Yeah. So this really relates to a book I wrote with Alexia and Taffy, who's one of my main co-authors. We wrote a book together called Life Isn't Binary, because we were both outside the binary in terms of sexuality and gender. So we're both bisexual or queer, and we're both non-binary in terms of our gender. But we felt like, actually, that's where it often stops with people, this idea of beyond the binary or non-binary is like, it's just about sex. Most people only really know about it in relation to sexuality. And then some people are beginning to understand, you know, with a few non-binary actors out there and things, there is this idea around gender as well. But actually, it's just a super helpful idea for all kinds of things. So that was the idea of the book. And yeah, so in terms of sexuality, I guess there's this real strong idea in our culture that people are either gay or they're straight. And of course, actually, in terms of the number of people who are attracted, like for young people, the statistics about 40% of people will say I'm attracted to more than one gender. So it's not even a minority, you know, who have a non-binary sexuality. It's, you could say it's a majority or certainly a significant group. And then in terms of gender, we're talking about anyone who doesn't experience themselves simply as male or female, or simply as the gender that they were assigned at birth, that there's some sense of gender shifting over time, or there's some sense of being in between or beyond or both, you know. And again, like when you do the study, the number of people who identify as non-binary is still relatively small, but the number of people who experience their gender is like to some extent the other gender or both genders or neither gender, or, you know, beyond the whole concept of kind of male and female binary. That's over a third of people, actually, according to one study. So again, a lot of people just don't fit these binary boxes. And so, yeah, that, as I said, Alex and I thought that this is a much more useful idea than just sexuality and gender. So why stop there, you know?
Amazing. Yeah, I definitely, well, first of all, Alex is also one of our speakers on this conference. So anyone watching right. who's interested in this topic, also check out Alex Yantafi's talk. Mm. And I myself, I identify as pansexual, which mm-hmm. for me falls under bisexual, which I consider more an umbrella term for
yeah. being
attracted to more than one gender. I don't identify as non-binary because I'm comfortable in the female body I was assigned, but I definitely have lots of moments where I forget I'm a woman or don't feel particularly feminine or like a woman, and I do lots of gender questioning. Mm. So I really appreciate you bringing this into the space, and I have so much I want to ask you about, but I know I'm interviewing you for my Beyond Boxes podcast, so we can go more into it then.
Yeah, I guess something that just occurred to me there when you were talking is that, you know, I guess we can think of this non-binary category as including the people who don't fit the one or the other, but also people who don't have a relationship to it. So you were talking about sometimes not really feeling that strongly identified with being a woman. And so people who are agender are people who just don't have a strong affiliation with gender, similar to people who are asexual, you know, not having a strong sense of sexual attraction to others at all, and aromantic, not having a strong sense of romantic attraction to others. And I think those fall under this broad category of non-binary as well. It's if you're both things, it's if you're between them, it's if you're beyond them, or if you just don't have any kind of relationship to them. And once you sort of expand it out that much, it is a lot of people we're talking about.
Yeah, definitely. And it's definitely something that, yeah, that we could talk about for hours, I'm
yeah.
sure. But just to stay on track with this yes. conference, which is the relationship conference.
Let's Nicely done.
thank you. Let's talk about relationship diversity and what that means to you, and why it's important, why diversity is important in relationships, and how like going beyond beyond binaries in terms of gender and sexuality also links into relationships.
Yeah, absolutely. So I feel like they're really linked together, gender, sexuality, and relationships. So, you know, that in a way that sexuality and relationships is the main place we kind of express our sexuality. And as we've seen, sexuality is all tied to gender in the popular culture, that sense that it's all about the gender we're attracted to. So this narrow box kind of cultural way of understanding gender, sexuality, and relationships is, you know, you're looking for a monogamous relationship or maybe serial monogamy, you know, and that's the place you're going to do heterosexuality or maybe homosexuality, but, you know, it's got to be one of those boxes, and that's going to be all about your gender and the gender you're attracted to. And particularly we have this, you know, real ideal of the heterosexual romantic monogamous couple, right? And so yeah, that's the super, super small. And then for each of those, instead of the binaries, what we want to get to is a sense of diversity. So this massive diversity of sexualities that are about all kinds of things, like not just the gender of people we're attracted to, but all kind of other aspects of what we're attracted to, and the things we like doing or don't like doing, and, you know, the feelings in our body. It's just, sexuality is just so much bigger than that. And then again, gender is so much bigger than that. It's such diversity in ways of being transgender or cisgender and binary, but gender, non-binary, masculinity, femininity, hugely diverse, androgyny. And the same with relationships, right? Again, we might get stuck on, oh, well, there's monogamy. And now we're kind of aware there's non-monogamy. There's some people doing that polyamory thing, you know, for example. And then it's like, no, it's massive diversity in the ways that people experience and express their relationships. And that's a much more useful model than a kind of binary of one or the other.
Amazing. And what is it exactly that you're referring to when you're talking about relationships, and like how do we relate, and is it just romantic relationships? Let's talk more about relationships.
Yeah
relationships, if we're going to be rewriting the rules.
Absolutely. Well, again, I think the big thing is people get fixed on romantic relationships, and that was what I was quite focused on in the book Rewriting the Rules, because that was my question of like, how can we do romantic relationships differently? But yeah, as well as seeing this diversity of ways of doing romantic relationships, which includes all kinds of different monogamies and non-monogamies and also monogamish, you know, styles there in between, there's also like this massive range of relationships in our lives. And again, culturally, we've become very focused on romantic love as like the place we're going to get everything. And that's partly because of a move away from communities and a move away from religion. So a lot of the things, historically, a lot of the things people used to be getting from their community and from religion, you know, like a kind of something to believe in and a sense of meaning and purpose and like, you know, people to support them, they're now often looking to like the romantic relationship to give them all of that. So a big binary I try and question is this kind of romantic partner versus friend, you know, where the friend is just seen as so much lesser, and we don't do the kind of conversations about relationships and friendships that perhaps we really need to do. So that's a big one for me, is like leveling those up and thinking, yeah, why are we prioritizing certain kinds of love over others? And what would happen if we kind of flattened that hierarchy and thought about all the people in our lives as important?
Absolutely. And I know for myself, my friendships are so important to me. And like my family, I'm also very close to my family. And, you know, I don't like having that hierarchy. I don't like the expression like friends or more, as if like friendship is not enough. But, and, you know, for me, and this is very much a personal thing, but I sometimes talk about having a Venn diagram of relationships, where I sort of have like friendship feelings, romantic feelings, sexual feelings, and sometimes those overlap and sometimes they don't. And I definitely have people in my life where I have very romantic feelings for and friendship feeling, but not a sexual attraction or sexual chemistry there. And then so I think it's so great to talk about the different ways in which we relate. Yeah. And so I guess we've sort of already touched upon it, but yeah, why is it important to consider how we relate rather than focusing on the one perfect partner or even the one perfect relationship style? And what is it exactly? Is that what you mean by relationship styles? What is it you mean by relationship styles?
Yeah, I think initially when I was using relationship styles, it kind of meant, you know, the different versions of monogamy and polyamory and other things that are out there. And now it's like, yeah, like much more moved into us like, yeah, this sense of like, how do we relate with others? And then that being something we think about across all our relationships, again, rather than the sense of like, oh, well, we need to work at a romantic relationship. And there we might do all kinds of conversations, especially if we are polyamorous or non-monogamous in some way. There's this real idea of like working at relationships and doing a lot of conversations, but that we wouldn't do that with our family, that we just take, or friends, that we just take it for granted of like, this is how you do those kind of relationships. And yeah, I think it's that we're really sold this message that like love is the answer, and that it's like about finding the right person, you know, the one to complete you, all of that kind of romantic idea. It really hurts people, you know, it hurts people who can't find that, you know, and they're sold this message of like, you know, this is the most important thing you can do in life, particularly for women still. And that, you know, somehow you're a failure if you remain single or solo. But it hurts people who get into relationships as well, because often the relationship cannot stand the pressure of trying to make that person into the perfect person, or they feel like it to start with and then they stop feeling like it. And there's a constant sense of, for both people or all people, that there's some kind of failure going on, there's something wrong with them. Instead of a sense of like, actually relationships are really hard, and, you know, and one person is never going to be able to be all those things. And, you know, and I think it also keeps people in pretty damaging relationship dynamics. You know, I think we have a really poor understanding of how traumatized a lot of us are around relationships, and how much we're trying to make somebody, you know, kind of make it all better. And when we're going into relationships over and over again with that kind of implicit agenda, we're setting ourselves up to fail. And it just perpetuates this horrible cycle where then it goes wrong, and then we think we're even more broken, and we're even more looking for someone to kind of fix it and make it all better. And, you know, this continues. So I'm really wanting to help people get out of that sort of cycle. And I do think, and this comes from very personal experiences, that I sort of saw this and I thought, okay, I'm going to stop looking for the one, you know, I'm going to stop looking for a monogamous partner to save me and make it all better and be happily ever after. Oh, I know, I'll go to polyamory. That's the other thing that people are doing over there. Maybe, you know, that's the answer. And then of course I just did it in the same way. I was like, okay, polyamory is going to fix me. And like, if I find the five perfect partners, you know, then I'll be, you know, if it's just about not putting the pressure on one person, I'll just put it across five people. That didn't work, you know. And then I kind of moved to more relationship anarchy, which is where you're trying to de-emphasize romantic relationships and kind of come up with your own ways of relating in a consensual manner. But again, I still kind of gripped that one as like, okay, that's going to be the answer. And then again, putting a lot of pressure on people and myself. And yeah, that's why I think we need to shift away from this idea that any kind of model is going to like fix it. And it's more to like, how do we relate with others? How can we relate in ways that are safe enough for everyone, that keep people free and flexible to change over time, where we're looking constantly at our patterns and whether they're showing up, and, you know, kind of doing our work where we're supported by others to do this, you know, so we're not sort of in this like little tiny kind of unit where we're playing out all our stuff with each other and trying to pretend to everybody else that it's all perfect when it's really, really painful, you know, just this a whole different way of relating, I guess.
Yeah, and I think there's something really key in what you've mentioned about, especially within the polyamorous community, there's often the idea that monogamy doesn't work, but because it's impossible to find one perfect person to meet all my needs. But if I find five perfect people to meet my five essential needs, then I'll be fine. So yes. I think it's so important to mention that, because I really noticed that in the polyamorous community as well.
All the right set of rules. It's like, okay, monogamy didn't work, we'll do polyamory. Okay, well, actually, you know, we don't like hierarchical polyamory, we're going to be egalitarian polyamory, you know, it's like, or we're, you know, we're going to be solo polyamory, and that's the thing that's going to work. And it's, you know, again, all of this diversity is wonderful. It's great that there's these different ways of doing relationships and people can find the best fit for them. But as soon as you're in it for like, this one's going to save me from pain, forget about it. It's just not going to, it's like trying to find the perfect drug, you know, it's just not going to work.
And I think what I'm really hearing, it's almost like you're talking about, you know, it's never going to work if you're trying to fit yourself into an existing model. And it's more about finding either which model or what just in general works for oneself. And that also can change and develop over time. That's definitely
will
something
do. Yeah, will do inevitably. And again, with all these things, we're sold this idea they're fixed, you know, that we're born with a sexuality and a gender, you know, or there's a natural normal way of relating. And that, you know, that we'll stay the same over time, or that we can, you know, in marriage, you know, that we can commit to exactly the same kind of relationship with this person and that all last 50 years. And this just isn't how people work. And where relationships do work actually best is where they can flex and change over time, you know, as the people in them change and as the relationship changes.
Absolutely. And I think another really key factor in what you were talking about is that feeling of failure. Like, if I can't make a relationship work, then I am a failure.
Yeah.
Rather than just, and I remember there was a time I had a really beautiful relationship. It lasted about 7-8 months. It was actually with, we were all like non-monogamous as individuals, but they were actually a married couple, which it was the first time I'd done something like that. But and it wasn't like a unicorn hunting on Tinder type of a situation. Two individuals I met at a party, and then they happened to be married, and then we dated as a sort of triad for a few months. And it was a very beautiful relationship, and it went really well, and we had very open communication, and we went through a lot of the traditional steps of a relationship where we sort of met and we went on a few dates, and then after a while we had a conversation about what we meant to each other, and we talked to our families about each other, and we went on a holiday together, and we did, you know. And then at some point we realized that we were wanting to go in different directions, and I wanted to go off traveling, and we didn't want to live in the same areas. And then I fell in love with someone else somewhere else. And there was a whole bunch of factors, but in the end we decided that it was time to end our relationship, and it ended very amicably. And we're still in touch, and we're part of a relationship anarchy support group with an international one where we meet on Zoom every couple of weeks, and it's really lovely. And I remember like crying on the phone to my dad and saying, you know, oh, I've another relationship that hasn't worked out, I'm a failure, or this. And he says, it doesn't sound like a failed relationship, it sounds like a completed relationship. You met, you had the chemistry, you connected, you did all the things, and then after a while it just felt like you'd got what you needed from the relationship. He didn't say it quite as eloquently as this, but
I was like, this is a great dad.
There was something really beautiful in that, in that kind of sentiment of, oh yeah, and I really know that myself, every single relationship I've had, I feel like I've learned something. And I was just talking to a friend the other day who's going through some relationship difficulties, and I was saying that for me, yeah, it's about every relationship I have is about what can I learn about myself and the way I relate in general, rather than, you know, is this the one and how many babies are we going to have together?
Yeah. And will it last forever? I mean, I remember like early days when I was doing talks about polyamory and somebody at a conference, you know, just said to me, oh, can these relationships be successful? You know, and I turned it back on them and I said, well, what do you mean by successful? Because what everyone seems to mean is if it lasts forever, right?
Exactly.
And, you know, your Venn diagram's super helpful here. This is something that Justin Hancock, who I write with as well, who I think, again, is also going to be in the conference perhaps. And we talk about Venn diagram of like overlap, you know, so it's just about, you know, tuning in to like where you're at and how what you want in relationship and how you want to do it and where they're at. And then, you know, where's the overlap or what way of relating might work for that, you know, and it might be that you're like, actually, we're in such different places now than we were, you know, 2 years ago, you know, let's kind of go our separate ways and feel fondly towards each other. Or it's like, oh, maybe we can renavigate this to be like a comet relationship, you know, where we're going to meet up, you know, once a year or something and have a wonderful conversation and a couple of days together. And that's great, you know, or yeah, maybe it's going to be like, oh, the romantic part's not there anymore, but actually it's still really good sex. Let's keep that bit, or, you know, let's co-parent together. And these other, you know, and it's just that kind of like separating out all these different dimensions of relating, you know, like you said, your Venn diagrams, and also having that conversation of like, where's our overlap, without that sense of like shame. You know, I'm really with that at the moment, that this, the cultural sense is that we sort of sign up to something. It's like we've, even if we don't get married, that we've signed this kind of implicit contract that says, I'm going to be this to you forever, and you're going to be this to me forever, in all kinds of ways and in all kinds of relationships. And then if you break it, it's like your fault, you're a terrible person. And they get to be really angry with you, or you get to be really ashamed of yourself, or maybe, you know, both, or all people go off and they all feel that sense of failure and shame. And it's just, you know, it's so unnecessary and so sad. Yeah. Mm. And I think your dad's way is a better way.
Completed rather than than failed.
Yeah, exactly. Definitely. Sometimes it's like this little, you know, here it goes round and then it's complete. And sometimes it's a much bigger circle, you know, over the whole course of our lives. And that's just okay. And again, with all relationships, that, you know, you're not obligated to anybody. It's about that ongoing navigation together and separately, and just, you know, finding what works for those people concerned, right?
Absolutely. And in the same way, often our friendships can fluctuate. We have friends where, depending on geographical location and circumstances and where we're at in our lives, you know, there'll be moments where we're really close, and then we might drift apart because we take different directions, and then, or end up with different romantic partners often is a reason for friendships to drift and then come back together. And I think that can be true in all different types of relationships.
Absolutely.
And so we're also talking a lot about, you know, what I mentioned, and you're talking as well about what's right for us as an individual. So let's talk about the way we relate to ourselves and how that has an impact on the way we relate to others, whether in romantic relationships or friendships or other types of relationships.
Yeah, I keep coming around to this one. Like, that, you know, as I said, Rewriting the Rules was my first book on these topics, and I started it with your relationship with yourself. You know, that was the first chapter, which felt really important. And I was kind of interrogating this like common idea of like, you have to love yourself before you can love anybody else. And I was like, well, you know, that's harsh. You know, like, it's really hard to love ourselves, you know, in a sense that a lot of these big philosophies like Buddhism and existentialism are pointing to, it's almost impossible, you know. And it's almost like the definition of an enlightened being is somebody who's just okay with themselves, like, let alone loving themselves, just thinks they're an okay person. So, you know, we literally can't, and what are you going to do, go away and be in a cave for your whole life and then come out at like 86 and be like, oh, I love myself, I'm ready to love other people, you know? It's like, that's not, but I kind of return to it over and over again, because there is a really deep truth in it as well, in that, you know, certainly my experience is I don't love as well, you know, or I don't love well at all when I'm coming from that place of not loving and valuing myself. And again, the other big influence on my thinking is Black feminism, and, you know, bell hooks, you know, says that we have to value ourselves and others equally, you know, and we have to kind of have this mutual kind of love, like that is love, in fact. That is, you know, these are the things that we call love that are really about trying to turn ourselves into something for somebody, or trying to turn them into something for us. It's not a loving thing to do at all. So I do think that ongoing kind of kind of want to say working on the self, but I don't know again about the concept of work, because again, that's so twisted in a kind of capitalist context. But, you know, certainly an ongoing deep relating with ourselves and learning ourselves very honestly and very kindly, because the only way we can be really honest about the stuff that goes on in here is if we've got a lot of kindness, right? That for me is essential to all relating. You know, that we're not going to relate well, or we're not going to love well unless we're doing a lot of that, and unless, you know, our relationship systems really support us to do that, and that the other people are also on side with that. That's an important thing to do.
I love that. I love that idea of, you know, being kind to oneself, being kind to others. And it reminds me of a quote I heard. I can't remember it exactly, but something around like kindness. What is it? It's honesty without kindness is a form of cruelty or brutality, but also kindness without honesty is a form of enabling. And I think that's so important when we talk about communication and relating, and to have, you know, and that it covers all kinds of relationships, but to have a combination of kindness and honesty with ourselves first, as well as with others.
Yeah. And again, this is where, you know, both Buddhism and Black feminism and many other kind of philosophies, you know, really emphasize practice. Like, we have to practice that. We can't just do it intellectually. It's like, it has to be our practice, you know, deep inner practice, but also our practice in the world with others, in again, a collective practice. And this is where it relates to such big, you know, it relates entirely to wars and human conflict. It relates to climate crisis, how we teach, treat other species. You know, it's not just this like, you know, I want to get more sex, or, you know, I want to have better partnerships, you know, or do more dating or something. It's like, you can't in a way separate that kind of micro level relating from this really big stuff that's happening in the world.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Because what you're talking about on a much broader scale is all about relationships. It's all about interpersonal dynamics, which is
how we relate. Yeah,
exactly. And so, shifting gears slightly, but actually kind of very in line with what we're just talking about on a big scale, but like, why are cultural and developmental trauma understandings vital for understanding our relationships, do you think?
Well, I think you just said it, and like, it was genius, because I totally put two and two together in a way I haven't before. But if you think about, so developmental trauma is this idea that, you know, most of us as kids go through. It doesn't have to be big traumas, you know, but relationally, we take on board some of these messages, you know, within our families, within our schools, about how we should be. We aren't taught well, you know, how to deal with the difficult emotions that come up. And we're taught ways of relating that are very much, you know, the kind of thing we've been taught about. And what you said about kindness without honesty, and honesty without kindness, these are two ways we often go, right? So the fawn response, you know, that a lot of us learn as a survival strategy, certainly I did, you know, to people please, right, is kindness without honesty. It's like, I'm going to shape myself into something for you, and then you'll love me, please, you know, because you're, you know, you've been through, you know, being abandoned or being really hurt by others, and it's, you know, this is the strategy that's just about worked once in a while, so you're going to keep doing it. And honesty without kindness is like the fight response, which is another way to go, which is like, everyone else is bad, and I'm going to blame them and judge them, and I'm going to try and make them something for me. I'm going to try and control them and make them into something for me. And so many of us, you know, have those kind of strategies, or the flight or freeze, which are the other two that are often named as kind of trauma responses. Mm-hmm. And they become these kind of not just a in the moment way we respond to a traumatic event, but more like a ongoing, like, relational way of being. And again, if we don't kind of really look at that, again, with the kindness and the honesty, then we can be so stuck in one of those as our go-to way of relating. And it is just going to keep hurting us again and again, because, you know, the fawn person is going to keep realizing they've just lost themselves in relationship and have to kind of like get out of that relationship to find themselves again. Or the fight person is going to keep pushing people away, and then, you know, feeling more and more hurt by relating. And again, the tragedy is it often reinforces the very thing that's hurting us, because the fawn person is then going to like go even more to the next one, like even more bend themselves out of shape to try and get that love they're so desperate for. And the fight person is even more angry when the next person lets them down, you know. It's like, it's just, yeah, really painful. So we have to have that going back, you know, and to some extent through trauma informed therapy or from through support groups or whatever way we do it, of like looking at some of those patterns, you know, you don't necessarily need to look at all the detail of where they come from, but I think feeling some of those feelings that have got stuck in the body, you know, those kind of somatic trauma kind of releases is important, like to really feel it on the embodied level. And again, there's a lot of practices out there to help people do it. And the other piece is the cultural trauma, which I'm sure you'll talk with Alexi and Taffy more about, which is, you know, that these messages that we've been talking about and these unjust kind of systems that pass down through intergenerational trauma, these ways of relating that we're brought up with that are just so, so problematic, are, you know, another part of it. So we need to examine those and shift those as much as we can systemically at the same time as like working on our inner system and shifting that as well.
Absolutely. That makes a lot of sense. And I think it also links back to what we were talking about between the sort of loving oneself before you can love someone else. Maybe it's not so much about, you know, loving oneself, but becoming sort of understanding one's kind of relationship patterns, understanding one's traumas, understanding and becoming aware so that we can at least understand if we're trying to get that external validation that we're seeking because we don't have it within ourselves.
Yeah.
And I think that there's definitely a link between those elements. And I was reflecting on what you were saying around that and just noticing again, sort of for me, in the way I relate, how so often I realize like if someone says or does something that I don't believe about myself, then even if they're saying it in a hurtful way, it won't impact me as much as if it's like something I already believe. So if I already feel deficient and unlovable and insecure and someone says something that will trigger that, or sometimes doesn't even say something but does something that I can interpret in that way, then that's going to be a lot more painful than, for example, if someone tells me that they don't like, you know, I don't know, my communication style. I'm like, well, you know, I feel like I have quite a good communication style. So let's have a conversation about this, for example, but it's not going to hurt me because it's not an area that I feel deficient about.
So we need to think about the stories we tell about ourselves and how they show up in these ways. And again, I think a lot of these practices are about kind of trying to let go of a lot of that investment in how we're seen by others, and also recognize that a lot of the time when people are relating to us in painful ways, it's coming from their trauma. And I think the more you've done this inner work as well, the more you can kind of see that and be a bit like, oh, okay, that's actually coming from a place of hurt in that person. And it's not really about me or this bit's about me, but the rest of it's like, I can let that slide instead of that sort of, when you're so like hooked into how everybody else is being and either judging it and attacking it, or, you know, trying to shape yourself to fit it or whatever.
Which again links back to sort of kindness and honesty with oneself and with others. So like if you can see that someone's relating to you from their trauma, then it's just about being really kind and understanding that and being maybe a bit more flexible and coming back to the conversation when not from a triggered state.
Yeah, well, I think that's a huge piece that Alex and I are going to be writing about in our next book, actually, this, you know, how do we then relate? And I think it's, again, kindness and honesty is a good combo, because it's not kindness as in, oh, this person's being really abusive, but because I recognize it's coming from trauma, I'm going to let them. It's much more like you said, not the enabler, but the much more like, okay, I am not going to be around you when you're dysregulated like this, because it doesn't serve either of us. I'm up for this conversation. If you're up for these kind of rules of engagement, and if the person's saying, no, I want to be able to berate you for an hour, you know, that's not okay. And you're giving them quite a useful message by holding that boundary. Exactly. So I'm saying it like I find this easy. This is the most terrifying thing I can imagine, but you know, I can imagine somebody being able to say that.
I think, but what you're mentioning, I think it's really good to remind people that it's easy to talk about, but not always easy to
practice. Yeah, please, FYI, that thing I just said, I can't do, but I aspire to be able to do it someday.
But I think another thing is really important that you're mentioning is that kindness doesn't mean not having boundaries in place. You know, and again, it's kindness towards oneself and others. It's not, and it's with honesty towards oneself and others of, okay, this isn't working for me right now. I need to be kind to myself. And that means putting up boundaries and being really clear about, you know, and I do, you know, I've done lots of nonviolent communication courses and that kind of thing, which is all about getting to the core needs of each person in the relating and how to.
Yeah. And I think consent is really useful here as just a wider concept than sexual consent. Like for me, it's about, yeah, what's the consensual way of relating, and also the trauma-informed way of relating, because I think, you know, there's often an attempt to do NVC or consent, you know, as a kind of bullet point, this is how to relate, which misses that actually when people are in trauma, they're not going to be able to empathize with each other. When they're in a trauma response, they're not going to be able to, you know, have that calm conversation or follow these rules. So how do we, this really tricky piece in our relationships and our communities of how do we recognize that depth of trauma and try for relating when we're not in that place, and how, you know, how slow then we have to go, and how to even notice when we're in those dissociated or dysregulated places, because a lot of us, you know, we've been there so much of our lives, it's just familiar and we don't realize that we're responding in a trauma kind of response way. So it's big, deep work, I think. It takes a long time.
Absolutely. That makes, And I'm so glad you're here and talking about it, and we're definitely going to have an interview as well around consent, so for people who are interested in that topic, to check that out. And I think we're coming to the end here now, so everyone who's probably loved listening to you as much as I have, how do we find out more about you and your work?
Yeah, so everything's on my website, which is rewritingtherules.com. It has all links to all the books through independent booksellers, and also lots of free materials. Last year I wrote so much on my blog about trauma and consent and plural and being plural, that those, there's now a free book on all those topics, which are kind of a collection of essays that I wrote last year about those. And there's a lot of zines as well. I really like doing these kind of illustrated zines, so there's a lot of those that are free to download on the website as well.
What do you mean by being plural?
Oh yeah, so this is the idea that that we are individuals, are a system as well, that we have multiple facets. So, and one way you might think of it is like we actually have all these trauma survival strategies in us. So even though I might have foregrounded fawn most of my life, I do have fight, and I need to get into a better relationship with that side of me in order to be honest and kind, rather than kind to the deficit of honesty, right? I really experienced myself quite vividly as a plural system, and there's a lot more people talking about this these days. And so I've tried to sort of synopsize the various kind of therapy literature about plurality in a way that's accessible for people.
Yeah, I love that. And I'm so glad you brought that in as well. It's what I refer to as the yes and. It's like I'm full of contradictions, and I'm not this or that. I'm that and this, you know, it's I'm both, and I can, and it, we're humans and we all are full of contradictions and, you know, strong and vulnerable and you know, feminine and masculine, and you know, and we all have different elements, and it's so hard when we try and put ourselves in boxes to feel like, you know, society is trying to put us in a box, and which is why I called my podcast Beyond Boxes, because we're going beyond those socially ascribed boxes.
And I think it can really tear us apart, you know, mental health wise, when we're trying to present oneself to the world, but we're really aware, you know, that we're kind, we have the capacity for kindness and cruelty, you know, and like you say, for deep fragility as well as strength, and, you know, confusion as well as wisdom. And like the way is to be able to contain all of that, like, and how do we do that? How do we become strong enough containers for all of who we are, instead again of just trying to be some bits and eradicate others, which is such a violent way of treating ourselves.
Definitely. So check out Meg John's website, rewritingtherules.com. And what are your social media handles if people want to follow you?
Meg John Barker on Twitter. And I think the same on Instagram, but Instagram is just pictures of nature, so don't be expecting any wise words on Instagram. And those are the only two I'm on. I came off Facebook, so.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. And I look forward to talking to you again soon.
Thank you.